pendant.
What do these things do?
Make you responsible for what you say.
Nah. Okay, last week I said I defined the topic, the next subtopic. Logically speaking, we've been talking about one topic and referring to, hinting at a second, which needs to be discussed together with it. What I've been discussing the last 3 or 4 weeks is the nature of ethics, the nature of the good, and why it's a yisod in emunah b'Hashem and in Torah. There's a second question, which if we don't give a positive answer to the second question, positive answer to the first question will be meaningless. And that's not a metaphysical question, but an epistemological question. Namely, do people have the ability to know what is good and evil? Do human beings have the ability to know the truth about ethics? All the proofs that I brought 3 or 4 weeks ago from Avraham Avinu and from basically from Avraham Avinu, but as well from the pasuk of Sitov Yashar and the story of Cain v'Hevel, etc., were all based on not merely that there is a good, but also that people can know it. In other words, Kadosh Baruch Hu not only says to Cain, "Why didn't you do the good? Because there is a good," but also he expects Cain to have known what the good was, or else the Musar, the Tochacha, would not have been in place. Similarly for Avraham Avinu, who says to God, "I know what is Mishpat, and I want to know why you're not fulfilling it." Logically, though, these are two separate questions. There could be, there are many things which might be true or not true, but it doesn't mean that we have the ability to know them. The question is especially sharp because of something which I said. Having answered the question of Plato and answered the question of the steel between the Akedah and the Parsha of Stone by saying that God is the good, then the claim that person knows the good is the claim that person knows God, which might cause some people to be taken aback. Bemet, I mean, maybe I can know geometry. Maybe I can know geography. Maybe I can know how to use these machines that are on my desk. But to know God, surely a person should be a little bit more humble about such things. There's a well-known theological statement that runs through all medieval philosophy, which says that God is unknowable. You can't know God. How can a human being know God? It's beyond possible knowledge. The claim that a person knows what is right and what is wrong on his own by using his intelligence, the statement would strike some people as being theologically suspect or being psychologically arrogant, or the two of them taken together. And therefore, I want to defend that statement, because otherwise, if I can't defend that statement, then I wasted my time the previous 3 weeks. It's meaningless for us to say that, oh, of course there's a real ethic, and the real ethic is God. But lemaisa, you have no way of knowing it, so halacha lemaisa, you're going to have to read the Torah or to get a direct hitkalut from Kadosh Baruch Hu. You need a direct form of prophecy in order to know what is good and what is bad. Nor will you be able to judge it or to examine it to see how it works, to see whether it's right or wrong, because it's like hearing something with piagvua. You have no way of understanding the meaning or the content or the value of what you're learning when you learn Torah. First of all, the statement may sound theologically suspect, but in fact is we make the statement in another area. I think we make the statement in another area all the time, in a very closely related area, in the area not of ethics but in the area of pure rationality. Most people, all people most of the time, believe that they can know what is rational and what is irrational. They can know the truth about, at least in certain very, very limited manners, about certain areas. Take the three laws of logic. Do I know that something cannot be true and not true at the same time? The answer is, I think I do. I rely on it to a great extent. Ad kedei pikuach nefesh. I mean, if I had to make a choice as to whether or not to go left or right and blow myself up or to make it safely across the bridge, one of the things that I use in my figuring out the answer is that I can rely on the fact that if this one has the bomb and that one doesn't have the bomb, it can't be true that the opposite is also true at the same time. I mean, we rely on our basic understanding of logic in very, very important matters all the time. And as the Rambam famously said, I rely on my understanding of logic to interpret Pesukim as well. If I found a pasuk which says something which I believe to be logically impossible, then I know that the pasuk doesn't say that. Or, Lahavdil, you could have said, I know the pasuk is wrong. In the Rambam's case, it says, well, I know that I misunderstood the pasuk. The Rambam says in the beginning of the Chelek Gimel of the Mornevuchim. In somewhat more general sense, you couldn't interpret anything. It's just, it doesn't even make sense to say that. No, we're going to rely on God to tell us the truth, but we won't use our own heads. Because if you don't use your own head, you can't even understand what God is telling you. In other words, the case in the Rambam is somewhat more extreme. God says that he has a hand. That's one of the examples the Rambam quotes. It's mentioned in the Torah. That God says he has a hand. We know, logically, says the Rambam, that that's impossible. And therefore we know that that's not what it says. But it's true even in less dramatic circumstances. The Pasuk says anything. The Pasuk says, Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe l'Emor. Your only ability to understand the Pasuk is based on the fact that you have a head. If you don't trust your understanding of syntax, of words, of what a word could possibly mean, then you can't basically interpret anything. Without a brain, nevuah doesn't work. A pasuk in the Torah can't work if you're truly brainless. If you're that firm that you don't have a brain at all, and there is a form of firmkeit which claims that. Not consistently, but sometimes you might hear that I'm so firm that I don't think. In other words, thinking is thinking about things that God's involved in. I think about what to eat, but to think about the meaning of mitzvot, to think about morality, to think about important things. No. I'm too firm for that. I rely on God. If you're so firm that you can't think at all, then you really can't be firm either. You can't understand what God is saying to you, in a general sense. So in logic, It's a well-known assertion and again, this doesn't contradict what I said about Avraham Avinu and the Akedah. And sometimes we make mistakes in logic. There's no logical contradiction between saying I can make a mistake and saying that I also know the truth. I don't know the truth infallibly. I don't know the truth perfectly. But what I think I know, I believe that I know until it'll be proved otherwise. Sometimes we can make a mistake in logic as well, usually only when it's very, very complicated. In other words, I don't make a mistake about the three basic laws of logic. But the Rambam believes, for instance, that his proof of the existence of God, which we talked about 5 or 6 weeks ago, is purely logical. It's purely logical. If you break it down to its steps, any one step there is going to be really simple. But when you get a very complicated proof, which consists of a lot of steps, then, yeah, you can make a mistake. And sometimes we discover that. I thought that, logically this must be true, and then I realized that I simply made a mistake. Geometry is more or less the model which we usually use to show how pure logic works. There's a certain philosophical question whether that's true or not, but that's basically, nonetheless, it's a good model. So when I learned elementary geometry, so the 10 axioms of Euclidean geometry were obvious, and then the next few steps were immediately clear. But when you told me that, I don't remember this anymore, but whatever, that some of something that you learned in 10th grade about some of this very complicated theorem, so I can make a mistake and get the wrong answer. Show me all the steps, I could still make a mistake if I was tired. But that doesn't mean that when I do understand it, I assume that, there are two possibilities. Either I do or I don't, it makes no difference. You can make a mistake about things that you know, and the same thing is true about ethics. I believe that Avraham Avinu knows what he knows, but he's aware of the fact that he could have made a mistake in any given situation. Therefore, he double checks and triple checks. And when he met God's direct command in the Akedah, they said he was wrong. So he might have drawn the conclusion in that case he was really completely wrong. So that's obviously true about logical matters. My claim now is it's true about ethical matters. I think the only reason why people distinguish between ethics and logic in this sense is for two reasons. One is that they're very prejudiced. They know that everyone thinks that logic is logical. But not everybody is convinced, for one reason or another, that ethics is logical. I stress the words for one reason or another. It could be for very, very bad reasons, because they don't want to have ethics obligate them. Or it could be for other reasons. But, you can't think consistently in a manner which doesn't allow, which doesn't agree that something cannot be true and not true at the same time. But you can think about a lot of things without agreeing that it's wrong to murder. So that's one reason why people don't automatically make the same assumption about ethics that they make about logic. But the other reason is because ethics is almost always on the complicated level. In other words, almost always. And when I talk about logic, so I mean the three laws of logic. To ask you whether or not you agree with the theorem number 2010 in the Euclidean geometry, so you understand that when you first see it, you don't know yes or no. You have to think about it a lot. Ethical questions, we skip the first steps, normally speaking. No one actually does the careful analysis of starting from the basic assumptions working out. I want to know whether or not you think it's right or wrong to kill Osama bin Laden in the middle of the night or something, some other difficult question. So those questions are always difficult. And therefore, we know right away that, okay, a normal person who's not overly arrogant will say, okay, I think my opinion is that I'm working my way towards it. You won't say anything with a great deal of surety. It happens to be that, yes, ethical questions are very often very complicated, and therefore, psychologically, a good dose of modesty is called for. But basically, the relationship, I think, I'm arguing, is the same. There are basic principles which, are, in fact, we see directly, we intellectually perceive as being correct. And then any given case is going to be an application of those principles through rules and understanding to what could be a very complicated case. And therefore, in the end, you get the right answer. I'm not now going to review all the proofs, because the proofs are the same proofs. I just want to point out, I'm reviewing, but not in the same sense, that one of the psukim I quoted, not the one which I quoted at most, but I think it really discusses that. The pasuk that says, "Ninutin nechem hayom etachim etamavet etov v'atara ubachatem b'chayim," what we call b'chira chavshis, is based on the fact that you have before you good and bad, and you have a means of choosing. God said to choose. It implies you have a means of choosing. God wants us to choose Tov over Ra, not merely do Tov over Ra. Otherwise, the whole pasuk is unnecessary. The pasuk just said there's some other place in the Torah, not in that pasuk. A different pasuk says, don't steal. So you won't steal. God doesn't say, Ani nutein lachem hayom et ha-tov et ha-ra ve-et ha-achilat matzah ve-i-achilat matzah. The pasuk says to eat matzah, so you eat matzah. But about ethics, Dafka says that you have a choice. It's before you, and you should choose. What does it mean to choose good over evil? It means to choose good over evil, which means to recognize that the good is the right, the good is the mandatory, the good is required, and the evil is to be avoided. And that's what that pasuk is talking about. Now the question is, but really, is that true? Why is it true? How is it in fact possible for a person to know the good, especially and specifically because I claim that to know the good is to know God? Isn't there a well-known principle that says that we don't know God? So the answer that I think Jewish tradition gives is that yes, people know the good, and the reason why people can know the good is because they have intellect. And if you claim that intellect has a roof, has an upper limit, and God is on the other side of that upper limit, human intellect does not reach to God, so the answer the Jewish tradition gives is two words, Tzelem Elokim. In other words, if someone is taken aback by the astonishing claim that a mere mortal can know God, the answer of Judaism is that the words mere mortal are out of place. A human being is not a mere mortal. A dog is a mere mortal. A bug is a mere mortal, and the Empire State Building is a mere mortal. But human beings are not mere mortals, they're mortal. But they're not mere mortals, because they're mortals who were created by Tzelem Elokim. Therefore, what we're going to discuss today for a few minutes is the concept of Tzelem Elokim. It's a phase which we learned very, very early in our education, somewhere between Kita Aleph and Kita Bet, because it's found in an early parak in the Torah, and we don't start learning from Vayikra anymore, we start learning from Bereshit. So it could be we learn it too young. You're really supposed to learn it in Jewish tradition, you're supposed to learn it in second grade, not in first grade. But modern day schools have change the Seder of Svarim in the Torah. But I dare say that it has not been well explained in regular Jewish education. You know what the words mean, but you don't know what the words mean. And you know how to translate the words into English, but we don't know what the words image of God mean. We know what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that you look like God in the length of your nose or the slant of your eyes or what's somewhat more sensitive to some people in the length of your beard. So what does Tzelem Elokim mean? There are a lot of answers in Rishonim as to what is being, not so much what it means, is what is being referred to. When the Torah says the man is created by Tzelem Elokim. All the answers will have to take the word Elokim seriously. And therefore they're going to mean there is something about man which is different than everything else in the world that reflects, that has a divine, that has a godly quality about it, that nothing else has. That's what the phrase is going to have to mean. So, let me mention one answer, a two-word answer, the answer of the Rambam. And although the Rambam doesn't mean to answer the question we asked today, but you'll see the way the Rambam's mind works. The Rambam says that Tzedmukim means reason. It means the ability to think. Which is exactly what I said 10 minutes ago. Because for the Rambam, to know that one and one is two is also to know God. Just like I claim that to know the good is to know God. Rationality, the truth, is God for the Rambam. And therefore, to know that which, to know truly, to know in by use of pure intellect, that which can know by pure intellect, according to the Rambam, connects you directly to God. That's his theory of Achdut HaMaskil VaHamuskal. To know the truth is to know God, and to know God is to be one with God, and that's how you get to Olam Haba. By knowing God, you become one with God. The Rambam said, and therefore the Rambam is famous or infamous, for having basically said, this is, it's usually thought to be a question on the Rambam, that not merely knowing that God exists is knowing God, but as Rav Chasa Kreskaz asks Rambam, and the Rambam's answer is going to have to be yes, knowing that one and one is two is also to know God. Because if you know something which is logically true, that's to know the eternal truth. It's not to know something about the world. That's merely true now. The fact that there's a shtend in this room is not to know God. But it's also not exactly true. It's not true in an eternal, supernatural sense. But one and one and two is true in a supernatural sense. Using the word supernatural the way I used it 8 weeks ago. Supernatural is something which is not dependent on the natural order. So whatever happens in the world, one and one is still two. To know one and one is two for the Rambam is to know God. And you get into Olam Haba for knowing it. Many of you should have thought that was a kasha in the Rambam. They just didn't think it was made sense that you get into Olam Haba for knowing mathematics. But the Rambam's answer is that yes, you can. You make it to a very low level of Olam Haba, but you'll make it. You'll make it to Olam Haba knowing mathematics, which is probably going to be a comfort to some of you in the room who that's all they ever plan to know. And those of you who think that you don't know mathematics, you should know that you're not going to Olam Haba. I'm saying the same thing. It sounds better. It's more emotionally satisfying. I think it's more intellectually satisfying. It's more spiritually satisfying. But the same point. If the truth is God, and ethics is the truth, and for that I dedicated the last 5 sessions. Ethics is the truth, and therefore ethics is God. And to know ethics is to know God. The Bible says to know something, to know, to use your intellect, is what the word Tzelem Elohim, is what the word Tzelem Elohim mean. Now of course I'm making a very narrow, by comparing the two, comparing the use of intellect in the Rambam sense, the use of intellect in the sense of using now, I'm making a very medieval assumption, one which is not well accepted today, and that is that ethics is a subject of intellect. But of course that's what I've dedicated myself to for the last 4 weeks. That person can know what is ethical and not merely feel what is ethical. When we say you have a conscience, that doesn't mean that you have a itch. It means that your mind is able to perceive the truth in the statement, it is wrong to kill, and the truth in the statement, it is right to help people. And everything, it's not always clearly perceived, but I think it should be perceived. Everything I've been talking about for the last 4 weeks was to, in one way or another, I'm not going into the exact philosophical underpinning of it, but to justify that statement. All other statements, which sometimes people use without realizing that they're being anti-intellectuals, that they're being anti-reality, anti-real ethics, is that ethics is a matter of feeling. So sometimes it gets confused because sometimes you can have the super opposite feeling, that feelings are real. In other words, if I say that I love steak, I'm saying something real about the steak, but I'm not. I mean, none of us seriously should think that. So ethics are not feelings, and ethics are not emotions, and ethics are not itches. If I've shown through that the ethics is metaphysically a real thing, then the way that we know ethics is to know ethics, and not merely to, the word intuit, for instance, very often in our language, is used negatively. But of course, original intuition is a form of knowledge. It's that knowledge which isn't based on complicated arguments, but direct perception. Sometimes you say, "Oh, you don't really know that; you just intuited." When people speak about women's intuition, when males speak about women's intuition, they usually mean women's mistakes, right? Which occasionally is right because, it's a mystery. But if you have intuition, yes, we intuit. We directly intuit that good is good and bad is bad. And that's because we have the ability to see. We have the ability, our minds can see what's good and bad as opposed to our eyes, which don't see what's good and bad. They see merely what is pretty and not pretty, which is pretty and ugly. So again, I have to tell you the truth now. In modern philosophy, the overwhelming majority of modern philosophers of ethics don't accept that statement. They also don't accept the fact that ethics is real. They don't accept that ethics is normative. They don't accept the fact that ethics is supernatural. All I've said till now is the Torah thinks it is. If the Torah thinks it is, then if a person can know ethics, he knows it by use of his intellect, and not because something is scratching him, he just has a bad feeling when he sees it. You know, the way we know that, let's say, not for everybody, but for most of us, the way we know that something is beautiful or not beautiful, aesthetics, if you're not someone who believes that aesthetics is real, which you might be, but if you don't, then you don't know that with your mind. It creates, here I accept what the psychologists say, what the psychiatrists say. If I think something is pretty, it's because the way it looks strikes some sort of a nerve in my head, which is similar to the way my mother used to arrange the mirrors in the room, and therefore I have a good feeling about it. Let's say aesthetics is merely a feeling. Surely there's nothing that I know of in the Torah which would say that that's not true. Keats thought it wasn't true. Keats thought truth is beauty, and beauty is truth, and that's all you need to know. But romantic poets think it wasn't true. But most modern people think it's true. I'm willing to concede the point. It's true. You don't perceive beauty with your head. You perceive it with your guts. You perceive it with your with your kishkes. But morality, I'm claiming, you perceive with your head. That's what Rambam says. Tzedek Elokim is intellect. Okay, that's just an example. Tzedek Elokim is intellect. But you realize the fullness of what the Rambam is saying. He's not saying that intellect is a very wonderful thing, and therefore the Torah calls it Tzedek Elokim. He's saying that intellect is divine. And when the Rambam says intellect is divine, what does he mean? He means that intellect is the ability to perceive the divine, to acquire the divine, to be one with the divine. Yes, if you view the metaphysical base that Rambam is talking about, then it really is extraordinary. Because the intellect is to transcend the little box that you are in, the world of sense perception, and to perceive, to acquire, lahasig, the word in Rambam's Hebrew, to know something is hasagah sichlit, to reach out and grasp. We say, you say it in English too. You grasp eternal truths. That means, that Rambam really means that. It means you grasp it, you become one with it. You're davekbo. Your mind takes on the shape of, according to the Rambam, the shape of the eternal truth which you are at present intuiting, which you are present perceiving. So that is an extraordinary statement. Rambam says that's what everybody does when they perceive the truth. They are not, you are a bundle of sense perceptions, you're a bundle of sensations, you're merely physical, but something in you is able to grasp that which is not physical. You're able to grasp ideas, and the ideas are eternal. So therefore, yes, you have ability. That's something which requires a special mice in creation. And the truth is, it's not found in other things. Tables don't perceive. Apparently, animals don't perceive either. But human beings are able to perceive the truth and know the truth. Again, the Rambam wasn't speaking about ethics when he said this. He was speaking about what's known as pure reason in the language of Kant. But he would agree, because Rambam did not distinguish between pure reason and practical reason, between ethics and metaphysics. He would say it about ethics as well. If you perceive that something is good, then you are perceiving God. And that's ability which, in fact, requires a special explanation. I've been given the explanation. But it requires a pasuk to say that man was granted a special thing. He was created b'tzelem. B'tzelem Elokim. Yeah.
Does that mean every single ethical quandary, given enough thought, you'll eventually come to the true answer?
It should mean that. It should mean that. It doesn't have to mean that, though. I don't want to go into now. There are two reasons why what you said might not be true. One is that the Rambam, for instance, is machlokes between Rambam and Rav Sajigan. The Rambam thought that indeed human intellect has upper limits. He just didn't think that the upper limit was where my from people 15 minutes ago placed it. The human reason can understand God, but not that much. So for instance, let's take in the area of pure reason, you can know God. What you can know about God, according to Rambam, is that he exists, that he has no body, and that he's one. Now there are other things which are true about God. And if they're true about God, they're true in an eternal, rational sense. They're not merely true by accident about God. But those are things you can't really perceive because you're not smart enough. Rav Sajigan is more sanguine, or let's say Mekubalim are more sanguine. I mean, people have a more expansive view of human intellect, think you can know more about God. So then it could be true about ethics. I can know certain basic things about ethics, those which we agree that we know. But some things might be too difficult for chosot, you're human. The two difficult, what I'm saying is that the limits to human existence, to human understanding, is different in not merely in degree, but in nature, from the limits of canine existence. Dogs are bounded, I and a dog are bounded by the same constraints in terms of gravity. I can jump a little bit higher. It's a difference of degree, but we're bound by the same constraints. We're not bound by the same constraints in terms of intellect. But nonetheless, you might be bound by some constraints. So that's one reason why we couldn't know, there's some ethical problems which are too difficult to understand. The other reason, which you might be referring to, which I'm sure you're not going to get into today, because it doesn't do what I'm talking about today, it could be that And the law of the excluded middle doesn't apply to ethics. In other words, it could be that some ethical questions where they're both true and not true at the same time. Those ethics might be not just more complicated in terms of its difficulty, it might be more complicated in its, in, at least in some cases, to its susceptibility to a right answer. If there's no right answer, then you can't know the right answer. That's a very much more complicated question. So, sort of similar to Elu Elu Dibelokim Chaim in the area of ethics. Is there, in fact, to every ethical question a right answer? I'm assuming today, as I've assumed till now, and I think we should assume most of our lives, that the answer is yes. There is a right answer. Just work at it. Work at it long enough and you will get to it. Or if it's perfectly mutter to take a shortcut, look it up at Shulchan Aruch, which is a shortcut, but you could have gotten to it on your own. You should get to it on your own. Whether or not there are some very, very complicated ethical questions which do not have a right answer, or to put it, I think, more accurately, they have two right answers, and it's a question which we're not going to discuss today, nor in the near future.
Are you saying that God is intellect and not emotion?
I didn't say that.
Okay.
I mean, the Rambam says it, but and I'm quoting the Rambam, but I didn't think it was relevant. You know, that wasn't under the discussion. I'm saying that that God is, among other things, intellect, and that God is intellectually is two different things. God is, number one, God has a mind, which is a Rambam assumption, which isn't particularly controversial. And two is that something the opposite, that God can be the object of intellect. In other words, this table doesn't have a mind, but it's an object of intellect. I can know it. I can know some things about it. So God is both what Rambam calls maskil b'muskal. God, when I think, God is the muskal. He's the object of intellect. He's the perceived. When God thinks, he's the perceiver, and I'm the object of perception. We know each other in different degrees and in different manners. So in that sense, yes, God is intellectually perceivable. Not everything about God is intellectually perceivable. I agree. The Ramban in the Hakdama to the Perush al Torah talks about Nun Shavei Chochmah. And he says human being can know 49 out of the Nun Shavei Chochmah, which is also not something that's obvious to many from people today. But then he says, but there's the nun, the highest level you can't reach. Highest level is the knowledge of God. He means that highest level you can't reach knowledge of God on that degree which he thinks you can't reach, because the Ramban Sefer is full of things about God. But there's the true, full understanding of God is something which even Moshe Rabbeinu, he claims there, couldn't reach. In one place, he implies that maybe Shlomo Melech did reach, but usually he's assumed to have said that you can't, it's impossible to be reached, it's beyond the theoretical. So there's more about God than there is more that is true about God than that which can be intellectually perceived. But what I do perceive, I perceive. And if I said that yesterday, that God is truth, that God is the good, and we perceive good, then that aspect of God we can perceive. Certain things about God we can't perceive. I mean, I don't understand how God can be both the good and also power, and also that I really don't understand. I don't really perceive how that's done. I just say that it's echad, but I don't really perceive it. Some things I can't perceive, but some things I can. So everyone agrees that there are some limits to what I can know about anything, and that may very well be true about ethics as well. Precisely because I'm saying that ethics is divine. If ethics was merely the rules of human existence, then presumably humans should be able to know it. But if ethics is not the rules of human existence, it's the truth about the truth. Those, if there are no human beings alive, if there's no world, if nation nivra ola, before the world was created, it was still wrong to kill somebody. Had no practical application, but it was wrong to kill people without reason before the world was created. Then you're not talking about the rules of human existence, you're talking about something which is simply truth. And for that, it's a chiddush that you can know it, and it's not surprising that maybe you don't know everything about it, but you definitely know some things about it. That's my claim. Now, what do I really want to say about Tzaddik Elokim? It's like, what are the Rambam? The Rambam is a nice pshat. The Rambam says that Tzaddik Elokim is intellect. Another famous answer, which is quoted by many in the Middle Ages, that Tzaddik Elokim is Bechira Chofshit. An answer that the Ramban unfortunately would not give, but others would give. It's not that different an answer. It's in fact the answer that's closer to what I want to talk about rather than what the Ramban wants to talk about. What is Bechira Chofshit? Bechira Chofshit isn't the ability to choose between steaks and potatoes. It's the ability to choose between good and evil. That's what it's about. When someone says that man has Bechira Chofshit, he doesn't mean that person can choose whether to go left or right. I'm pretty sure that, I don't know whether it's true or not, but I suspect the dogs can choose that as well. Maybe not the same kind of a choice, but that's not the topic. When someone in the Middle Ages says that what's special about human beings is Bechira Chofshit, freedom of the will, they mean freedom of the will in ethical matters. That's what they're talking about. So they're explicitly saying that, yes, and that's a very special quality. It's quoted with words that Tzaddik Elokim apply. It's a divine ability. Non-divine things which don't share in the divine, things which don't have a godly aspect to them, don't have bechira chofshet, because they can't choose between good and evil. And why can't they choose between good and evil? Because they can't perceive the difference between them. To them, it's the same thing. It's just left and right. And if it's just left and right, then you're not choosing between good and evil. You're choosing between left and right. Something which I said, I think a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, and I want to repeat it, that if you, halacha the maisa now, if you choose between good and evil, but not because the good is good, because the evil is evil, but for some other reason, then your choice wasn't an ethical choice. In other words, it could be that by accident, or somewhat more practically, by parental training, by social pressure, by habit, you do good things. For most of us, we haven't had an opportunity yet to kill anybody, a real opportunity. So most of your lives, you've made a lot of decisions, and most of them have been ethical. I'm not talking about cheating on the SATs, but you haven't killed anybody yet. You know, and you probably helped a lot of people. But many of those decisions were not, in my opinion, were not ethical decisions, because you weren't choosing the good because it's good and the evil because it's evil. You were choosing the good because it was there. Everybody was giving tzedakah that day, so you gave also. Or for some other reason. Including the reason, which I've been explicitly arguing against, if you choose good because God told you to, and not because you think it's good, not because you perceive it to be good, in the extreme sense. You don't even do the argument that I said that Avraham Avinu did. If God said to do it, then it must be good. No, you just do it because God told you, then you haven't made an ethical decision. You made a religious decision, you made the right decision, but you haven't made an ethical decision, you're not being ethical when you make that choice. So bechirah chofshit in the value sense of the word is the ability to choose between good and evil. And that's what the pasuk means. I'm placing it on the table so that you should be able to see it, distinguish. I'm placing it in front of you, and therefore you should examine it and choose the good because it's the good. Recognize that the good is the good. So if that's what tzedakah means, then it's explicitly what I'm trying to say. Yes, people have a special ability, unusual in the natural world, to perceive the difference between good and evil. Why is it unusual in the natural world to choose between good and evil? Very simple. Because good and evil are not natural qualities. It's not unusual in the natural world to choose between red and blue. Because red and blue are natural qualities. So the natural world has the means of, as a test. You can use a natural test, a scientific test, to find out whether something is red or blue, or large or small, or hot or cold. But the quality of good and evil is God. It's not a natural quality. It wasn't created. It was there all the time. Things merely reflected. So therefore you can't do a natural test, which is the natural abilities that everything has, eyes, ears, etc. You can't do a natural test to distinguish it. You need to distinguish between good and evil. You need to do a non-natural test, a supernatural test. What's a supernatural test? I'm back to the Rambam. The ability to know things is a supernatural ability. You don't see with your eyes that something is good. You perceive it with your mind, and that's different than that is a non-natural ability to distinguish between non-natural qualities. And therefore we've left the area of nature and we're dealing in, if the quality that I'm trying to perceive is supernatural, I need a supernatural ability to see it. So the answer is yes, Tzadokim, God gave you a supernatural ability. What I'd like to do now is to try to explain basically. I said till now I didn't say anything. I said that the pasuk says that human beings have a very special quality, and that quality is, I'm translating the word Elohim to non-natural, to supernatural. People have a supernatural ability. I didn't explain it, nor do I think it could be easily explained. I'm going to try to a little bit explain it. I don't understand it completely, but I'm going to try to explain what the meaning of Tzelem Elohim is, such that the result of it will be the ability to know the good. Again, I repeat, with the possibility of mistakes, but nonetheless, to know the good. Before I interpret the words Tzelem Elohim, I just want to remind you, to stress more than I did in the past, a point about Avraham Avinu, who is our hero for these series of lectures. It's not just that Avraham Avinu was a autonomous, ethical individual until he woke up the morning of the Akedah and faced the decision whether to continue to be ethical according to his own lights or to obey God. What the Pesukim to some extent, but the Midrashim for sure, stress is that the autonomy, the Avraham Avinu's ability and desire and derech of making his own ethical decisions based on his own mind was the defining mark of Avraham Avinu's life, and that's what made him Avraham Avinu. It's not just that it's mutter to think ethically. But what the Midrashim stressed in Avraham Avinu's life up to the Akedah was the reason why Avraham Avinu was Avraham Avinu was because he thought ethically and made his own ethical decisions, including specifically, I think I quoted this Midrash, what he said to God in stone. Hashofet kol atzlayas ha-mishpat. The Midrash in the beginning of Lecha says that's why God chose him to be the founder of God's plan in the world, to be the founder of Am Yisrael, which of course makes the Akedah all the more, say, poignant, or ironic, or difficult. Avraham Avinu in the Akedah is not giving up something that's precious to him, he's giving up the cornerstone of his life. And I don't mean Yitzhak now, but I mean the ability to know whether something is right or wrong. The Rishonim always stressed that God didn't tell Avraham Avinu what to do. Well, if he did, he told him in such a manner that it left great parts of the choice up to him. Maximum, he told him to go someplace without telling him where. But most of the time, he didn't tell him anything at all. Avinu chases the Abat Malachim on his own. He discovered, Hachnasas Ochim, no one claims, no Medrash claims, that no Gemara claims that Avraham Avinu was Machnas Ochim because God whispered to him that that was a mitzvah. He was Machnas Ochim because he was Avraham Avinu. And therefore, God came to him as well. Etc. This was what made Avraham Avinu different than the rest of us. That we look at Shulchan Aruch sometimes. But he never looked at Shulchan Aruch because he never had Shulchan Aruch to look at. Nor did God help him out in the meantime. Now, what do I mean by Tzadim Elokim? What do the words mean? I'm going to say now, it undoubtedly means a lot of things. But I want to say simple pshat. Usually when you hear a shir and someone says, it's very, very complicated, I want to say simple pshat, he means, I want to say the greatest chiddush that's ever been heard. That's the way rabbis present something which they don't want you to argue with. So it's pashat. The other hand, you've never heard it before. So I'm saying simple pshat. But okay, but I'm really saying simple pshat now. And what's a tselem of something? The context is creation. God's making the world, making Adam Arishon. So other things he didn't make B'Tselem Elokim. Man he made B'Tselem Elokim. What tselem did God make the Dorgan? Man is made B'Tselem Elokim. What Be'ezet tselem asa Elokim et HaKelev? What's the right answer?
Tselem Kelev?
Of course. The tselem of something is what we would call today the plans, the architectural plans. When you first draw up a plan, and then you build a house. Your house is supposed to look like the plans. Look doesn't mean necessarily look, you know, it doesn't mean necessarily look physically. The plans look different than the house, but the house is constructed according to the limits, according to the projections, according to the amounts, according to the design. The word tselem here means design. Everything is created according to the design of the thing as whose name it bears. God has a design. God knows what he wants. He wants dogs. So that means before God created the dog, he had, this sounds very Platonic, this is the way Plato basically describes creation, but there's no other way to think about it, frankly. He's right, Plato. God has in his mind, he constructs, he orders from his architectural department, which of course, Hashem Echad, so it's just part of God. But God, the carpenter, orders from God, the architect, a picture of a dog. And then God, the carpenter, makes a dog. Since God is very good at this, the dog looks exactly like the plan of the dog. The dog is made, B'Tselem HaDog. That's how he made cows. That's how he made grass. That's how he made, satellites. That's how he made cell phones, which can also apparently record. Amazing. Where have I been the last 10 years? This is new, right? Because 2 years ago, people gave me these little MP3 players. Now I seem to be speaking on the phone. There's no one on the other side of this phone listening, is there? No one's paying to have this sheer broadcast. I don't know where. Okay? God has a plan. The guys who made the cell phones did the same thing. They first drew a plan for the cell phone, and they made it. Now, because they weren't God, what happened? The cell phone doesn't look exactly like the plans, which is why it breaks down occasionally. But that wasn't in the plans. It wasn't supposed to break down unless you have a very conspiratorial theory of the nature of American industry, in which case they wanted to break that every now and then so that you can get you to sell you a new one, etc. God came to make Adam Arishon. What was the plan? What was the design? What was the architectural design to which the actual construction of man was subject? So if I'm right about the meaning of the word tselem, then what's the answer? Not man. God did not make man, but tselem ha'adam. He made man bear Betzalem Elokim. What could that mean? So if you understand the word plan, it's possible to understand it. It doesn't mean that man is God. It means that the limits, the plan defines what you can't be more than. The limit, the theoretical plan, the ideal, we use that word. Tzedek means the ideal. The ideal picture of a man is God. Now, no particular man actually looks like that. As opposed to, truth is, many dogs don't look like the ideal of dog either. Because I know, I'm pretty sure that God's ideal of dog had four legs, but some dogs only have three legs. They might be missing their teeth. They're all imperfect. Everything is imperfect compared to the ideal plan, the Platonic idea of something. Well, human beings are very imperfect compared to the ideal. In fact, they're by definition imperfect. But nonetheless, the ideal picture of man is God. What does that mean? It doesn't mean that therefore you're very smart. Because as I said, it's always imperfect. It doesn't mean you have any particular quality which is, wow, that's a spark. We use all kinds of metaphors to talk around the idea of Tzedek Elokim. So there's Nitzot Elokim Mimal, or there's Neshamat Elokim, there's the Kabbalah that says, that explains how the Neshamat is part of God, etc., etc. Those are all words that discuss around it. There's no particular thing you can put your finger on and say, oh, that is not natural. There's not a single person in this room I'm going to say, oh, the fact that you are, what, that you're tall, that you're short, there's nothing here that's non-natural. Everything about you is natural. But what it means, what's non-natural about man is that he can surpass himself. He can be greater than he is, because a dog can only be a dog, because that's the ideal of dog. A dog can never surpass a dog. But human beings were created with Tzelem Elokim, means that they were created where the thing which defines them is not what they are, but what they're not. Specifically, what they're not but could be. Now, since we're talking about something which is infinite, Shmuel is infinite, so as I said that you could be, it doesn't mean you could be tomorrow, or you could be even in 2 days, or even in a million days. It means you could be in a purely theoretical manner. You'll never actually get there because the path is infinite, but at any given moment you can become closer to that ideal. And this is a theory, this is what's known in philosophy as process philosophy, that at least in some things, the definition is not what you are, or the proper definition is not what you are, but where you're going. And I think that's the meaning of the pasuk, B'tzelem Elokim. It says that man was created not to be this tzelem, but to what defines him is where he's going. What defines him is the process in which he's at. It's a difficult concept. It's easy concept to understand the words. It's a difficult concept to grasp because we're trained constantly not to think that way. Definition defines what you are. That's what definition means. I'm saying what you are bahoveh, what you are right now, well, not what you really are, not what you are in stop photography, but the thing that defines you, the word that said, let there be man, the defining sentence that God issued as he created man, didn't say what Adam Rishon would look like, what he would be at that moment, but it defines him by what he could be. That's my pshat to the words Tzelem Elokim. Man is created according to the plan, which in fact is not what he looks like, but the plan of what he could be. And the nafkamina is that a person is capable of infinite transformation, of infinite transcendence. A person can transcend himself. You can be better tomorrow than you were today. Other things in the world cannot be more than what they are. If this table has a defined strength of 50 pounds, then if you put 51 pounds on the table, it will break. And the table cannot become stronger than it is without adding another piece of metal. But a human being, what you are now is what you are. You're capable of doing A, B, and C. You're also, among other things, in moral issues, you're capable of being good to the extent that you are. It is, in fact, impossible at the moment. You don't have the ability to be like Avraham Avinu. But in another second, you could. Or at least you could become closer to that ideal. Which is what Avraham Avinu did. When he woke up in the morning, he hadn't yet killed anybody, including his son. He hadn't sacrificed anything for God. And God says to him at the end, Atayadati ki yirei Elokim ata. And the well-known theory, which we'll talk about some other opportunity, Rav Chasdei Kvestis explains, it's a well-known educational theory, it's pushed by the Chinuch all the time, is that by doing A, you become more capable of doing A than you were before. The Chinuch, the somewhat less grandiose manner, the Chinuch explains that when you give tzedakah to a poor person, you become more merciful than beforehand. Now, there's a paradox involved in that, because you had to be merciful on a certain level to give tzedakah in the first place. When you gave tzedakah to the ani, it wasn't because I forced you, that wouldn't work at all. You gave tzedakah to the ani because you had pity on him. How much pity did you have? The amount of pity necessary to give $1 and not $2, because that's what it was too much for me. I gave $1 because that's how merciful I was. You give $2 because you're more merciful. So the $1 guy has how much quality of mercy does he have in him? We'll call it $1 worth, 10 points worth. The chinuch says after you've done that once, you now have 11 points. You've transcended yourself. You've done the impossible in a natural world. The steel has strengthened itself. The good has goodened, has, there must be a verb for good, has been
improved.
Not bad. Improved. I hear the word. Not bad. Latin root, B-E-N-E, has benefited itself, has made itself better, has improved itself. The good has improved itself by the shita of the chinuch is by doing actions. Okay? Forget the shita. The shita is very important for practical ethics. There might be other shitas. But the thing is that you can become better than you are. You can become greater than you are. It's probably true in areas other than ethics as well. A person can transcend himself. If you believe the stories, a person can run faster than he can run. I don't know if they still tell the story. Any of you hear of Roger Bannister? Great hero of my youth. I guess it's so long ago that they don't tell it anymore. Okay, it doesn't make a difference. Now, we all know it's a common thing in sports. You know, the guy who really couldn't do it, but then, you know, at the end of the movie, he was able to jump higher than he could jump before. Maybe it's true there too, but I doubt if it's true in muscles, but maybe it's true in muscles. But it's in areas of value, which is what we're talking about. We're not talking about, I don't want to jump like God jumps. God doesn't jump. But I want to be, and I could be, ke'elokim, in terms of value. You can become better. More divine, more than merely human. And that's why we never speak of the phrase B'tzelem HaAdam never appears. It's in Israel, in Hebrew, there's a Chiloni phrase. I'm not sure people even realize what they're saying, but it has a long history. Where you want to talk about very, very important things, so you say B'tzelem HaAdam. It is delivered by people who invented it 100 years ago. They took a pasuk and they ruined it on purpose. But, you know, like, human values as a compliment. So if a person acts really disgustingly, we say in Hebrew, you might say shehu mechalel et tzelem ha'adam. He's impugning the image of man. But of course, in Yiddishkeit, we never say something like that, because tzelem ha'adam, is the tzelem of savages. You want to say somebody's impugned value, you say he's impugned the tzelem Elokim, asher bo nivra ha'adam. He's taking himself down rather than going up. That's, I think, I've said now a pshat in a pasuk. I believe that is the pasuk pshat in the phrase, Tzelem Elokim. What I've really done now, which I think was what's nice about, in terms of a little pashanut now, what's nice, is that I've said that the Tzelem Elokim is not something you can put your finger on. In other words, there's nothing about you that requires me to bow down. If you meet God, you've met something which is intrinsically different, and you bow down. But I'm not going to bow down to any of you, because there's nothing about you which is different in quality than the dog. The physical facts about you are more or less the same. A little bit more of this, a little bit more of that, a little more of this. And what I've said is that the thing that's special about you is what you're not. But you could be. Now, there's the fact that you can be more, the potential, is the divine. Not anything that you've reached. Let's say you use your potential and you become better than you were. You become smarter than you were. So the point you've reached is also not divine. It's the fact that you were able to transcend yourself that is the divine. That's my pshat to the pasuk. Now, what does it have to do with our topic? That is the reason why a person can know God in general, and specifically, what interests me, is he can know right from wrong. He can know good. He can know good and evil, because that is the meaning of true bechira chafshis. Tremendous arguments. When we talk about the form of evil, maybe we'll talk about it. There are tremendous arguments in philosophy as to whether or not the words free will even make sense. Basic philosophy, basic Western thinking is based on causation. What does it mean, free will? So, okay, but I'm going to ask, what caused the free will? It's a paradox of understanding where free will can even be discussed, let alone to decide whether or not people have it. But most of these discussions are based on viewing the paradigm of free will as a choice between going left or right. Okay, it's interesting in ethical matters, but they're really talking about the ability to decide whether to go left or right. Yes, well, if you go left and something pushed you left, you went right, something pushed you right. There's a famous paradox which is always misquoted. One of the other things that will contribute to your ability to have intelligent conversations with people. What's known as the paradox of Buridan's ass. Buridan was a late medieval philosopher. 15th century, I believe. Maybe 16th already. And the way it's usually quoted, in very good literature, I mean, like the New York Times could quote it this way, that Buridan claimed that if you put a mule in front of two identical piles of hay, identical in all respects, and equally distant from his hungry mouth, there is no rational way to choose which one to eat. So Buridan said, the mule will die of starvation. What Buridan actually said was, you think the mule will die of starvation? Buridan was interested in showing that you can make decisions that are not based on rational reasons. If you're hungry, then you tell the, you know, the mule will say, I don't know, so I'm going to go left. All right, I don't know which one. But he will choose in the end. That's a little bit of intellectual trivia. But it's well known that Buridan claimed that mules die because of a lack of ability to choose between two identical piles of hay. He actually said the opposite. But, you know, that's basically the paradigm in philosophical discussions of the problems of free will. Like, how do you choose? If you chose in the end this way, it must have been because something had to cause it. I'm not interested in those kind of choices. We're talking about the choice between good and evil, and I think there is a reason why people choose good over evil. There really is a reason. There is a cause. The cause is that the good is good and evil is evil. It's not a natural cause. Nothing pushed them in the way. It was a perception that It's not an arbitrary choice. When I choose between steak and potatoes, that's arbitrary. When I choose between good and evil, it's because I can't imagine making any other choice. It actually is a totally decided choice in advance. There is a 100% reason why you have to choose that. The good said to me, you have to choose me. And if you listen carefully, the evil said, you can't possibly choose me. If you use your intellect, when you saw this is the good and this is the bad, you saw this is the mandatory, this is not the mandatory. But that's what free will means when we use it in that context. It's the perception that this is good and that is evil. How is that connected to Tzem Elokim? Because Bechirah Chofshit is in fact the ability to transcend yourself, meaning to transcend your natural definition. Bechirah Chofshit means that even though I have been, if you took a camera or a meter or some sort of scientific information and you weighed me, you would get the following results. This is what I'm worth. This is what I'm capable of doing. But I don't choose between two possibilities that I have. I choose to the possibility which is impossible, which is greater than I am. Avraham Avinu chooses to sacrifice Yitzchak even though he isn't good enough to sacrifice Yitzchak, and therefore he becomes good enough to sacrifice Yitzchak. It's a spiral rather than merely a flat line. And that is, yes, that is the essence of understanding the difference between good and evil, is perceiving that something which I have no natural inclination to do, but I perceive that I should be doing it. Should is a future word. Should is a potential word. I don't have any natural inclination to help you or not to help you. I'm not married. I don't have a psychology which makes me want to steal. Nor do I have a psychology which makes me want to do good things. Obviously we do, but that's the immoral part of morality. The morality is when, as far as my natural inclinations, the way my brain is wired, how tall I am, how short I am, how good a feeling it gives to my favor. I eat chocolate because it gives me a good feeling. Some of us give tzedakah because it gives us a good feeling. It does happen. But then it's not a moral choice. The moral choice is, it doesn't make a difference to me as a natural entity whether I give tzedakah or not. But I perceive that it should. I perceive that it requires of me to transcend my natural state. And I can do that. That ability is what I previously, 10 minutes ago, defined as being a Tzelem Elokim. And that is, in fact, a non-natural ability. It's Elokim and not Adam. It's Elokim and not Adama. It's Elokim and not nature. Because in nature, things do what they are naturally inclined to do. Acid burns because that's what it is. And hot water is hot because that's what it is. And fire burns because it's hot. And ice freezes because it's cold. But in the non-natural world, in the world where what defines you as being a natural thing is a non-natural definition, to be like God, then you can do something even though you can be hot even though you're not hot. You can turn something on fire even though you're not hot. That you can't do, presumably, as far as we know. But you can, yes, you can make a moral choice even though nothing naturally about you define that moral choice. It's not between two barrels of hay. It's between what's right and wrong in God's world. But yes, in our world, there's two barrels of hay. difference between right and wrong from a natural perspective, from the perspective of some natural philosophers today, is like the choice between going left or right. You can either kill people to get money, or you can go and get a decent job and make money. It's the same thing. I will explain, the society doesn't like it, there are laws against whatever, but in the natural world it's the same thing. In the non-natural world, in the supernatural world, it's a difference of Yom Balayla, difference of Chayim Mavet, difference of good and evil. The fact that we can perceive that world and make a choice is because when we do that, when we use our brains, we use our minds, excuse me, when we use our minds to see that something is good, and we make the choice, we use our Ratzon to make the choice, we are acting non-naturally, because we're not responding to natural phenomena. That is what's called Tzad Malokim. It's the ability of man to be like God, to act in a non-natural world rather than merely in a natural world. And that's why I think the answer to the question in one sentence, how could it be that a man can know something about God? The answer is because it's created by Tzad Malokim. Now, what does that mean? It means that not that the difference between Avodah Zarah and Avodah Hashem is Avodah Zarah thinks that you are God. And Avodas Elokim says that you are never God, but you can come closer and closer to God. Who discovered that? Who discovered this distinction I just made? It's almost the same thing. Who discovered that difference between Avodas Zarah and Avodas Hashem is whether you are God or you are going to be God in the infinite and unreachable future?
Avram Avinu.
That's a good answer. Before Avraham Avinu, or after Avraham Avinu, not Avraham Avinu. Who was the first philosopher who discovered this? Has to be a great philosopher? Come on. Who said that you will be divine if you choose between good and evil? One of the great characters, one of the great philosophers of human of the world. You know him.
Plato.
Ah, guy.
God?
Of course God knows it, but he didn't say it. Who first said that if you choose between good and evil, that is a divine quality?
Not Rambam.
No, the Nachash. V'yitem k'elohim yodea tovara. The reason why you didn't think of it is because you don't think he's a positive character. He is a positive character. He's not a positive character. It's the difference of how you emphasize the kafa dimyon of k'elohim yodea tovara. If you think that you are God because you make choices, then you're an Ovid Avodah Zarah. If you think that you're like God, but only in the sense that I'm a pale reflection of the real thing, and I'm coming closer and closer to it, the reason why it worked, Adam Rishon wasn't a fool, it worked because it's almost the same thing. In fact, literally it is the same thing. What he was promising to Adam Rishon was that you will be divine, and frankly, that's what Yiddishkeit promises man. It all depends how you understand the Kafa Dimyon. Okay, you eat an etrog. I like that medrash. You eat an etrog, and that makes you God. It doesn't make you God. If it was the right thing to do, it would make you more like God. If it was the wrong thing to do, it would make you less like God. But you have to keep on that road all the time. You never get to the end. It's an extremely subtle difference. Morality is a process, and what's divine about human beings who live in the natural world is not that they also have one foot in the natural world. Sometimes we read those medrashim. The Medrash says that when God created man, so the three things about man are like Menal Yonim, three things about Menatachtonim. And we always have to say that there's something, and then you become misty-eyed. There's something about man which is a spark of the divine. What do you mean by the word spark? If you take it literally, yeah, there's a little spark there. The word spark means, the reason why the Mekubal used the word Nitzotz is because a spark isn't fire. It makes fires. What's divine about man is the fact that you can move. Not that you have something. Not that you can put in your pocket. The Nachash was basically seducing Adam and Chava by telling them that if they do A and B and C, they'll have the divine in their pocket. But we don't have the divine in our pocket. We have the divine one step ahead of us. And we chase after it, and it's always one step ahead of us. But our chasing after it is, in fact, what you could call the Tzelem Elokim Bo'olam Hazeh. That is what, specifically to the best of our understanding, that is what's different between morality and other areas of Yiddishkeit, including Yiddishkeit. I'm saying to our understanding. I don't necessarily understand why exactly eating matzah makes me more like God. I can take this to my mom's theory. Look at different theories, but all those theories are indirect. But in ethics, what's special about ethics in the Torah is that it's not indirect. Being ethical is making you more like God. And that's not I'm summing up now. That's not al cheshbon. That's not in rather than obeying God. It is rather than obeying God. In other words, it's becoming like God rather than merely obeying God. And that's why it's not a stira to Torah, but in fact it is the essence of Torah. That's why everything else in Torah was based on Adam Rishon's quality as an ethical individual and not on his quality being an obedient individual. Avraham Avinu wasn't obedient in any story that we know of. I assume he was. But the stories of Avraham Avinu, including when he jumped into the Kivshan HaEsh, he wasn't being obedient. God hadn't spoken to him yet. Avraham Avinu wasn't special because he was obedient, which is very often considered to be the ultimate religious quality. He was obedient because he was ethical. And on that basis, God then gave him mitzvos or sub-mitzvos, let's say mila. Mila is a real mitzvah. God added it to him, but the structure, the superstructure, was his ability to be like God. Hitalech lifanai. Exactly what I said today is exactly the meaning of those words. It's not a drush. Hitalech lifanai, walk in front of what I'm telling you to do. Ve'yei tamim, do mila. I'm giving you an eruv mitzvah because you are constantly moving ahead, and in fact ahead of what I've told you. But nonetheless, it's ahead. It's going in a given direction. What direction is Avraham Avinu heading in? He's in front of God, but where's he going? He's going towards God. He's not going someplace else. Otherwise, it wouldn't be valuable at all. Avraham Avinu is going towards God without God telling him where to go. So God is behind him, but also in front of him. And that's, then you get other mitzvahs. Avraham Avinu had one mitzvah, the mitzvah of Mila. And we have more than that. We have a couple of hundred mitzvot. But the superstructure has to be that we transcend ourselves and come close to God. That's the meaning of ethical life. And the stira between, do you obey God or do you obey ethics? I hope I've tried to show why it doesn't exist. And in fact, not only doesn't exist, not only give it a teretz, but it's one, and therefore you don't need a test. On the contrary, I'm not saying because I have to say it. It wasn't that Plato made me make this up. He did. But I'm thankful to Plato for making me make this up. Because Plato forced us to form this theory, we now realize the true meaning of the relationship between ethics and God to begin with. It's Hainu Ha, and therefore only ethical individuals can be the recipients of God's mitzvah. Okay, that, any questions? Say it, Yofi. We finish now this particular topic in all its aspects. We will come back to the question, the logical questions we raise will be consumed with all the time, because any other topic we talk about, we're going to be talking about, among other things, the contradiction between what I think and what God thinks. In other words, we can talk about the contradiction between logic and the Torah and any topic we talk about. But we finished talking about this particular topic, which is a very, very important topic, and I believe it is yisod to understanding anything else. The next topic is a logical continuation, but not of the logical problems of something else. Next topic will be Hashgacha, since we're talking about what we're supposed to do in the world and how I have to do things on my own, but I have to do with God's will. So the place where that interacts is, to what extent does God hold my hand or push me in one direction, and to what extent do I do things on my own, which is the question of divine providence, Hashgacha Pratis. And so we'll talk about that for a few weeks. From there we'll get to the problem of the problem of evil, which is basic problem in all Jewish, in all religious theology, and that should take us long enough to keep us busy for a long time. That's it for today.